Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today, our topic is a bit unsettling, being prepared for disaster. Perhaps something we don't really like to think about all that much. But hardly a day goes by that we don't see on the news some part of the world afflicted with either man-made disaster from nuclear power plants that implode or terrorist attacks, or natural disasters like earthquakes, tsunamis, wildfires, severe storms. Just a year ago, at about this time, the Anchorage Bowl lost hundreds of trees from high winds that blew them over like toothpicks. And in case anyone's forgotten, the big quake was in 1964. Next year's the 50th anniversary. It's true, we Alaskans live through a substantial winter every year. We learn to have some survival gear in our cars and layer our clothing. But are we really ready for the next big one? Today's show will help you answer that and explain what's expected of you in a disaster. In our studio today, we have three guests who don't have the luxury of not being prepared or not thinking about disaster. That is, at least in part, what they do. So please welcome Kevin Spillers, the director of the municipality's Office of Emergency Services Management, Emergency Management. That's welcome, great. Kevin. And we have Mark Mew, Chief of Police for the Anchorage Police Department.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And then we have Mike Abbott, Chief Operating Officer for the Anchorage School District, and Emergency Management falls under your responsibilities.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to you, all three of you. Now, I approach this like your average citizen who's probably unprepared. And when I started thinking about being ready for a disaster, I thought of my top questions. And so I'm going to throw them out there. You don't have to answer them, but these are for our listeners. It might help them think of what they want to know because they can call you and ask. So I thought, is 911 really the number we're supposed to call? Or is that really just, would we overwhelm the system if we call that? I wondered about how much we rely on cell phones and cell towers, and is that a good idea? Another thing I thought about was, if I'm supposed to be responsible for myself, should I be organizing my neighborhood? You know, no man's an island, so maybe, you know, a little preventative medicine might be a good idea. So I started thinking along those lines. So let's go to our guests and talk a little bit about getting ready for an emergency. And I'm going to go to Kevin Spillers. As we were chatting here before the show, Kevin told me there were two questions top of mind for most citizens. So let's talk about those because probably people want to hear.
Sure. Thanks for having us. The two questions that I think we get asked the most are how long would it take to evacuate Anchorage? And then where are all the shelters located in Anchorage? And those are good questions. And the frame of reference for those, so I can put it in context, comes from the old civil defense model. And I think folks may remember back in the 60s and 50s, the Cold War era, where there were actually shelters built for, it was more along the nuclear fallout type. And these places were essentially empty, and they were stocked with food and stockpiled. And then some places in the lower 48 that have hurricane or tornado threats do a similar kind of thing. Up here, that model just doesn't work, particularly for the kinds of hazards we'd face, earthquakes, you know, some of the other things. And so so they're not reliable. So what we really have to rely on heavily, as you pointed out, was individuals being prepared. So that's what we really like to focus on, is helping individuals prepare by educating them what kinds of things they need to do to prepare and sustain themselves for a period of time through an emergency.
Don't be thinking you can jump on a plane and get out.
No, that's not going to happen.
Or jump in your car and drive out.
And so the shelters in Anchorage are really, we determine those based on the conditions or the situations. And essentially, there's some predetermined facilities, some municipal facilities, and also the school district has facilities that
would be considered the go-to shelters. But that's a changing list depending on the event.
Exactly, depending on where it is. So the message here is don't go running to your nearest school. The schools are primarily shelters first for the, and Mike Abbott will tell you this, for the school kids and the staff and the families. And so once they've been able to have family reunification, and then the resources that they might be able to spare, then we can open it up to general population and sheltering. Now, there are some other facilities we have, rec centers and some of the other larger municipal facilities that can also work as shelters. But once again, it depends on their condition after a seismic event or some other hazard. So there's a lot of flexibility. And your question would be, well, how do I know which shelter to go to? And that's because as a good citizen, you're going to have a battery-powered operator turned radio turned to 7:50 a.m., and they're going to be able to broadcast and tell you where the shelters are in the event the power is also out. So mm-hmm. we'll work with the broadcast media and the weather service to put out the message on where shelters are located and how to proceed to those. But primarily what we want folks to do first is be able to shelter in place for at least 5 to 7 days where they can. I think that leads to the other question, which was, how long does it take to evacuate Anchorage? And the answer, there is no answer to that. I think in context, Anchorage, we wouldn't consider it for an evacuation like you would a city down in Tornado Alley in the lower 48. We talk about evacuation here in Anchorage. We're talking about area-to-area evacuations, one area of the city to another area where there are shelters. Mm-hmm. Because there's simply just no place to go. There's one way into town and one way out of town. And when we start moving large segments of the population around, that's a pretty serious incident. We're going to get a lot of help from the state and the federal government on that.
Let me throw out our phone numbers for people, because we just dealt with, you know, two pretty big pieces. You're not really going to be able to get out quickly if that was your plan.
That's correct.
And B, where are the shelters? And mm-hmm. so let's throw out the phone numbers in case people have questions about that.
Sure.
550-8433 if you're in Anchorage. And outside of Anchorage, you can call 1-888-353-5752, or you can send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's go over to you, Mark. As I sort of met you all and invited you on the show, I learned that Mark came from the school district or spent years in emergency management at the school district in between your two careers at the APD. So really, we've got some experts here. We even said this is like the emergency management brain trust right here in this room right now. So from your extensive experience, let's talk about what you think would be top of mind for the public and that you want them to know.
Well, I'd like to flesh out one thing Kevin said, and that is, you know, if everybody tried to leave Anchorage, it's not like some cities in the lower 48 where there's 4 or 5 or 6 different freeways leading to anywhere in the country. You know, the column of vehicles is going to guys in front are going to burn up all the gas and eat all the food until finally the whole thing grinds to a halt someplace near the Canadian border. So mm-hmm. that just won't work. We need to hunker down. Everybody needs to get used to the idea that we need to take care of ourselves here, that escape isn't really the option. Now, the other thing I'd like people to think about is you're used to calling 911. You're used to making that call when you need help. During a widespread disaster, I'm not talking about a localized emergency, but I'm talking about a citywide disaster of an earthquake.
Major
type
earthquake.
Of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The first responding agencies are also going to be suffering their own infrastructure problems. We may not have all of our vehicles. We may not have all of our communications available. We may not have all of our facilities up and running. We may have lost some of our own employees. Either they're injured, killed, or we can't find them, or they can't get in here from Eagle River or whatever. So we'll be responding to an unusually huge event with perhaps fewer resources than we normally have. So we have to triage the city. We have to prioritize the things we're going to do, and we have to take the more serious ones first. That is our challenge during a disaster. The way the public can help is by taking care of themselves so that we don't soak up those people don't soak up resources unnecessarily.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's so important to be self-sufficient, so that we can give our scant resources to the people who really, really, really need it. And everybody else is, they're uncomfortable, it's inconvenient, but they can more or less keep their lives together for the next few days and until we get over
the shock.
The original power curve here.
Right. And I'd like to go to Mike Abbott from the Anchorage School District, just because when I first approached Mike to be on the show, I said, what about all those parents that are going to come screaming into the school? You know, and he said, well, we're not going to stop that. So, Mike, address how the school district looks at that.
Sure. If there was an event, area-wide, or even a school-specific event during the school day when students were in our buildings, we know that parents would immediately try to get to their students, try to get to their children, and we don't want to prevent that. There might be some very limited types of events where we needed to secure a building because of a public safety risk or a facility safety risk, but you can be sure that as soon as is humanly possible, we will reunite families with their children.
Do you expect people to call the school, or is there any advice for parents?
We think they will try. We think that the school's call-taking capability will be overwhelmed almost immediately. Folks can be assured that it is the single highest priority of every school principal, every teacher, every school district employee to protect the safety of kids. So every measure possible at a school site or district-wide will be taken to ensure the physical safety of the students that we're caring for. So if something happens, if there's an earthquake or a hazmat spill or something, and a parent feels like they need to know the condition of their child, they should try to call. If that doesn't work, they should feel free to try to get to the school. And we will take every effort possible to reunite them with their child. And if they want to take their kid home with them, they can do that. If they just want to, you know, sort of put their eyes on them, that's fine too. And if the school's still open.
I saw looking at the district's website, there's a lot of, what are there, 56 schools in the Anchorage School District?
98.
Oh, excuse me, 98 schools, okay. And actually what I saw was different schools had their plans, so very school specific. So your school, you should be able to find out where your kids would be going if they had to leave the school.
That's correct. Every school, by law and district policy, builds an emergency action plan. And among the things they talk about are their evacuation sites. So if for some reason, like in the event of a fire or some other event at that building, and the building, they couldn't stay where they are, every school has a relocation site. It's within walking distance. It might be another school if there's another facility within walking distance. Might be a church. Might be a commercial facility. There's
some
place where
they can
go.
So parents hear the show today, they should, and they want to know. They can go to their principal and find that out.
I guarantee you, every principal has that on the tip of their tongue.
Right.
They are very well aware of that. They practice that. Many times a year.
I know one of the things you said to me on the phone was a junior in high school in 11th grade will be the most practiced,
They've done more drills by the time they're 16 or 17. If they've been in the Anchorage School District, and frankly probably any school district around the country, they've been doing fire drills and lockdown drills and stay put exercises. In Anchorage, we do them once a month in every building.
Mm-hmm.
There's one exercise or another.
Yeah.
So your kids are doing, generally 8 exercises a year,
mm-hmm.
times 10, 12 years. You could easily do 100 by the time you graduated.
You know, one other thing, and then we'll go back to you, Kevin, but I was thinking it's a real opportunity for parents to have that talk, not the birds and bees talk, but the communication talk. What are we going to do? Go ahead, Mark. You want to jump in there?
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Uh-huh.
This is Mark at the police department.
Yeah.
But something, that I think parents should get ready for is in a big emergency, probably the cell phones aren't going to be working. They're going to end up coming to the school. If there's something happening in the school because it's either damaged or there's a shooting in there or whatever, the kids will be staged somewhere else. So parents should be ready to approach a staging area, follow directions, being told to where to assemble, and they'll present their identification. There'll be an attempt to get them matched with their student. And it's not probably going to be a scenario where they get to go right into the front office and do things
depending on the
normal way.
Yeah,
yeah, depending on the incident. If the kids are out of the school, if there's an emergency in there, it's going to be a staging area kind of thing. There'll be a staging area for the kids, and there'll be a staging area for the parents, and some organized way to match them up. And a lot of parents are going to be frantic, and it's good to think about that now so that you're prepared for that setup,
you show up, but also maybe a chance for you to talk to your kid in advance of any incident, so that they know what you're going to do as a parent. I'm going to find you, or here's what I expect you to do as my child in the Anchorage School District.
Right.
Wait for me. I'll be there.
And what we don't want is a parent snagging their kid and running, because then we think the kid is missing. And then we're going to spend, the school district and the police department and the fire department search and rescue people are going to spend a whole lot of time looking for a student that we think is injured in the school when the student is home with their parents.
Right, right.
So it's very important that we get people checked off the list.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if this is too granular, but we've been talking about people being ready to take care of themselves for 5 to 7 days. So let's talk about really what you need for that. And I jump back to you, Kevin.
Yeah, sure. Basically, three rules. You're going to get a kit, and we'll talk about that, make a plan, and stay informed. So we talk about getting a kit. What you want to have are, and there are different kits out there, but what you're looking at is primarily you can count on the water being disrupted or water service being disrupted. So you need a gallon of water per person for at least 5 to 7 days, or said another way, a family of four, that's about 28 gallons for a 7-day period that you would need.
That's more than we have.
And that's for, you know, potable water, drinking and hygiene. You'll need food. You know, once again, the best way to do food is the freeze-dried stuff for 5 to 7 days. You know, special considerations, there are baby formula, or food allergies, or those kind of peculiar things, bottles for infants, you know, any other sort of dietary restrictions for the elderly, or those kinds of folks. A first aid kit, a battery-powered or hand crank radio, and NOAA weather radio with tone alert and extra batteries. That's how you're going to stay informed. So having those extra batteries is a big deal. One of the things we found in the power outage was people had a lot of the stuff, but they hadn't checked the batteries or didn't have extra batteries. So a whistle to signal for help if you need. Dust mask to help filter contaminated air, and plastic sheeting and duct tape to shelter in place. Moist towels, garbage bags, plastic ties for personal sanitation, wrench and pliers to turn off your utilities, manual can opener.
Knowing where your utilities are.
Yep.
Could be something.
Cell
yeah.
phone with charger, local maps, of course, important papers, and these would be in a waterproof container. Things like your wills, insurance policy, contracts, deeds, those sorts of things. Immunization records, bank and credit card numbers.
Oh, my gosh. It's a lot.
Oh, yeah. I could go on and on here with this. One of the biggest things probably are your prescription meds and your mobility aids. And that's a one that's particularly important for seniors, those with disabilities, special needs populations. There are some unique requirements that they have, and we've got some other supplemental information to help those folks out. That's available on our website, www.muni.org/OEM, or you can call our office, 343-1401, and we'll help you with that if you have unique needs or think you have unique
great.
Needs.
Yeah. We did put some links on the website, alaskapublic.org, so yeah. And if there's any others that come up today, we'll add them just for the benefit of the public. Let me throw our numbers out there one more time. And if you've just joined us, we're talking about being ready for a disaster and who's ready. Maybe there's a percentage of the population that does it, but there's a lot of us that don't. So we decided to pull in some experts here to sort of help us think about what would happen in Anchorage if there was a serious disaster, and to give you the information that you need, because you're expected to be able to take care of yourself if you're not medically injured for 3 to 5 days. And
five to seven days.
Okay, sorry about that. So if you've got questions about that, give us a call, 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 if you're outside of Anchorage, or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. If something really big happens in Anchorage, and this is to any one of you that wants to jump in since you're all pretty familiar with what would happen, something happens, say an earthquake, who's in charge? And I know it takes a while.
Well,
they're all pointing Kevin Spillers from
I think I can help with this. The best way to answer that, once again, to kind of put some things in context, the mayor is still in charge. Mm-hmm. But when we have that level of emergency, I think there's some things that occur there. He can issue an emergency proclamation, and that gives him special powers that helps the law enforcement guys, the fire guys out, allows him to control resources and assign personnel to jobs that they might not otherwise be doing. allows him the authority to do things out of the norm, and to have special provisions in place like curfews, limit, you know, firearms and alcohol sales.
Mm-hmm. Can really change the tone of what's going on.
Absolutely. And then moving up the list, the governor, so that's your local emergency proclamation. And then the governor, of course, with a state proclamation, he has even additional powers. They can, I don't want to use the word commandeer, but they can direct resources to focus on the response effort. This includes, going out and contracting directly and getting private resources, heavy equipment, those kinds of things that we might have in state here.
Yeah.
So the level of authority is still there. I mean, what happens is...
I thought it might be, the Army. The National Guard. But I'm going to interrupt you and just take a call, and we'll come back to who's actually running the show. Hi, Nick. You're calling in from Wasilla. Welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hi. First time calling. I really like the show.
Well, great. Glad to have you on. What's your question?
Well, I'm not real sure the level of authority will still be there if all levels of communications are shut off. And the gentleman from APD mentioned earlier that in a real emergency, the cell phones might not be usable. And if that's not the case... If it's not the case of an EMP, I don't know why they would turn their cell phones off except for to block communications or to keep the people from basically saving themselves.
So are you thinking there must be some other form of communication for the emergency teams?
Well, I know that there's a lot of ham radio operators and there's a lot of people who would hope they had some other form of communication, but if he's talking about them voluntarily shutting off the cell systems, which is what it kind of sounded like, and I don't specifically doubt that scenario, it sounds like they're going to wreak a lot more havoc than they're going to attempt to circumvent.
Well, we're gonna go to Mark Mew from the APD and give him a shot at that question for you, Nick, okay?
Yes, this is Mark. We wouldn't shut off the cell system. I didn't mean to imply that at all. It's just that...
I didn't mean the APD would.
No, we wouldn't do that.
I didn't imply that either, but...
We wouldn't do that. What I was referring to is the fact that the towers could sustain damage and that...
It's a fragile system.
And that the network itself will be overwhelmed. And we've even seen the cell systems bogged down for local disasters like airplane crashes. So we don't think the cell system will probably be as reliable as most people would like it to be. Texting will probably work better than voice, but it will be impacted in some way. It won't be fully functional. I'm not saying the whole system goes down, but it will be operating at a lower level than what the amount of need is going to be. As far as the city goes, we have a pretty robust radio infrastructure. It's brand new. It's been 10 years in the making. It's very robust. We have a lot of towers with backup generation. A lot of redundancy built into that. It's going to sustain some hits, but we think the tower coverage is enough that we'll have fairly good communication even if we take even if at least 20% of our infrastructure. I think the emergency services will still be able to communicate with each other without competing with the citizens who are trying to use normal telephone and normal cell service.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you, Kevin, you mentioned going to 7:50 a.m. I mean, if you've got the means to listen to a radio, a hand crank radio or something, that's really what you're going to use to get the word out.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good question. It's okay. How do you exercise command and control in a crisis? And as Mark pointed out, for responders, there are alternate sources. We're not relying on cell towers, things like that. There's a robust radio system. Likewise, with the Emergency Operations Center, reaching other agencies, we have other ways of doing that other than through your normal telephone channels to do those sorts of things. So the civil structure is still in place, though. Your civil government is still in place, and that doesn't go away because there's an emergency, and we get help from a lot of folks. But that whole thing about
chaos,
it's not immediately going to what do you call martial law or anything like
right.
that.
Right. So basically, people would listen depending on how bad the situation is, or if it continues to progress, they're going to get information. So I maybe I'm naive, but I thought, well, J-Bear's right next door. That's got to be an advantage for Anchorage to have. Not that they're going to come in, and but they would be a resource for us, no?
Yeah, they would, and not just J-Bear, and you know, emergencies come in all sizes too. So yeah, there's you know, things in place, military assistance to civil authorities. You know, in a time of emergency.
Yeah, I'm sure there'd be ways it would happen.
Absolutely.
They wouldn't just move in and take over. But
well, the good news, like you say, point out is the fact that they're there and they're a strategic asset and a resource. So not just for disasters, emergency, but for national defense. So they're going to get a lot of attention. So we're going to benefit from, you know, getting that Air Force base up there, back up and running. We're going to we're going to benefit from that, and they're on board to help us out.
Yeah.
And even if the military did participate in a emergency response, they would do so under the leadership of the civilian authorities.
Mm-hmm.
So there might well be guys in, you know, green uniforms running around working on roads and bridges and providing medical assistance and public safety and things like that. But they'll be doing so under the leadership, either in that likelihood, probably of the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So the key decisions will continue to be made by civilian authorities.
And how does FEMA get involved? Now, that's an exponentially big event. How do they get pulled in?
Kevin here again. You know, the way it works is, like I said, emergencies come in different sizes and flavors. And, you know, we have emergencies day to day that police and fire handle, and then they raise up a little bit. You know, the power outage is an example. And as they go up in scale, then you go to emergency proclamation where there's going to be a big impact on the city, but that's local. From that, our next step up is the state, and we notify the state. That's where we get resources from the state. When we no longer have the resources within the municipality to deal with things, we go to the next level with the state. And then if they can't help us, then they go to the feds, and that's where FEMA would come in.
Mm-hmm.
So we know just by planning that there are certain levels, no notice events that are going to require almost immediate assistance from FEMA, earthquakes, that sort of a
big
thing. And so that's how they get brought into the loop. We can get hold of the state very quickly. We can notify the governor's office very quickly, and that starts the ball rolling.
Yeah. I have another question that came to my mind just because it's been in the news so much. We have a port that's undergoing transitions. It's, you know, being rebuilt, and it's probably a vulnerability for us. What do you think might happen in the situation of something that affects our port?
Yeah, and that's a good way to say it. Is one of the reasons they're working on it is to improve its capabilities and make it more robust and less vulnerable. But you hit the nail on the head. In an incident, a large seismic incident, we can expect the port to be affected. The degree to which it affected is hard to say. Everything that comes through Alaska, or 80% of the stuff that comes through Alaska, to include relief aid, will come through that port. So it will continue to operate within the limits of its capability, and there are contingency plans to go to use alternate means, go to alternate ports and ship
ports.
By air. And the other thing, too, is a piece of critical infrastructure. You know, you've got all kinds of other critical infrastructure down there. So it's going to be high on the list of things that's going to get immediate attention to get up and running. So, you know, in order for commerce to even get back online, that port's got to be up and running. So it's going to get a lot of attention real quick.
You know, one of the things we talked about before the show began a little bit is we're kind of an island up here, so it may not be our disaster that we're affected by. It could be something on the West Coast that stops shipping. And so that's another way Alaskans need to think about this, that they might need to take some extra responsibility to make sure they're ready, because we're so dependent on what comes in that port. And even if our port's working, but the other ports aren't.
Well, we learned this is Mark at the police department. We learned a big lesson on 9/11, because, as you recall, all the air traffic was stopped. We had so many airliners crashing that all airplanes were ordered to land, and nobody took off for about a day. And so it was September. We had a full town full of tourists. All the hotel rooms were booked. Then all the flights came in and landed in Anchorage, and nobody left. We had a double load of tourists. There was no place for them in the hotels. There was no place to shelter these folks. And we could rustle up about 400 blankets that day. Didn't come close to the need. So that really launched the municipality and the school district into a decade-long program of building out sheltering capacity. here in Anchorage. And we have a state of the nobody. I don't think anybody's got school shelters like this town has available to it.
Well, that makes me feel good to know that.
It should. And there's been a lot of effort and a lot of resources dedicated to the establishment of 22 different schools as shelter locations here in Anchorage. And in the event of a area-wide emergency, the city, the municipality, would determine which sites would be used and how they would be used and how folks could access them. And the district would support that, but primarily, once we'd made sure that all of the students and staff were safe, we would then become basically a landlord to a shelter operation that Kevin and the municipality would generally lead. Mm. And as Mark said, we have the capability to shelter tens of thousands of people in those facilities.
Own power, our food.
Our own heat.
Sanitation. Mm.
We have dual-fueled boilers at most of those. So even in the event of a natural gas shortage or disruption, we could heat many of the shelter sites with diesel fuel. They've all got backup electric generation capability. They've all got on-site emergency supplies, at least enough to get the shelters started.
Septic vaults. I mean, we don't need to be on the water or power grid or anything.
Oh, that really was launched by 9/11, actually? Would you say that?
That got its genesis there.
Wow.
That, the school district commissioned a study, and it got us working down this road.
Wow. Well, we're just going to take a little break here. If you just have been tuning in, we have Kevin Spillers, Director of the Municipal Office of Emergency Management, Mike Abbott, Chief Operating Officer from the Anchorage School District, and Mark Mew, the APD Chief. And we've been talking about what will happen in Anchorage if the next big one hits and how should we be prepared. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we are talking scary emergency management. Actually, it's scary if you're not ready for it. So my guests today are Kevin Spillers from the Municipality's Office of Emergency Management, and everybody in the room pointed to Kevin when I said, who's in charge when the big one happens? Mike Abbott is here from the Anchorage School District. He's the Chief Operating Officer, and emergency management falls under his rubric or his role. And then Mark Mew, APD's police chief, is here. So we actually do have a caller on the line, so I think I'll go ahead and go to them. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you. Hey, I'm in Anchorage, and I live here. And Anchorage has two roads in and out, one north and one sort of southish. If something happened that the city had to be evacuated, how the heck would we do it?
That's an excellent question, and we're going to punt to Kevin.
Yeah, that's a good question, and let me help put it in context. We talked a little bit about this earlier. When we talk about evacuations in Anchorage, what we're really talking about is not evacuating the city, and we equate that with more like abandoned ship. There's no plan to abandon Anchorage, which is what you might be talking about if you try and pair it to something like a tornado evacuation or something in the lower 48. When we talk about evacuations here, we're talking area-to-area evacuations within the city. Because as Chief Mew pointed out, there's nowhere to go. I mean, there's one way in and one way out. And
we're going to be here.
Yeah. So, in fact, we can count on other people coming here. So what we try and do is prepare ourselves the best we can, and it's more of a shelter-in-place is primarily what this show is all about today, is how do you prepare yourself. Evacuations you know, are area to area. So you when we talk about evacuations within the city, we're talking about going from one area of a city to a less affected area of a city.
Not leaving the city.
No.
Yeah. So I think Louise, the first part of the show, actually Kevin said that was one of the most asked questions, and here it was one of our first questions that came up. That really, it isn't a plan to leave; it's a plan to shelter in place. And we did cover some. And we'll probably try to get back to it in the second half hour. How do you do that? How do you get ready for 5 to 7 days of taking care of yourself? So I hope that helps. It's a reality check. You know, we're really not going to be able to slip out and slip away.
One of those things, this is Mark at the police department. Kevin was reading a list here a minute ago of some of the supplies you'd want to have. And one thing that I don't know if he brought up or not, but having some cash on hand is a good idea.
We haven't mentioned cash.
Because the banks are going to be closed. You might not be able to get to them even if they're open. If there's power outages, the ATMs aren't going to be working. So, you know, if you can find a store that can sell you something, it'd be good if you had some cash.
Yeah, that's great.
If I might jump in here, Mark brings up a good point all about the cash, and this is PFD season coming up. So PFD also means prepare for disasters.
Ah.
And so a lot of people ask us that, do we have kits available or who's going to buy their kit for them? And we can help them with the items, understand the items that go in that, and you can really do it pretty cheaply, just a few dollars a month or a few bucks out of the old PFD to upgrade your kit or get started on it. And if you get a list and each month you buy a few more items, by the end of the year you've got a pretty good kit.
Yeah.
And you add to it and you maintain it that way.
Yeah.
So it's not a very expensive thing to do, and we can help you with that. There are different ways to do it, but what we recommend is that September's Emergency Preparedness Month. It's also close to PFD time. Is, you know, plan on spending a little bit of that PFD money towards your emergency kit.
There's the trip to Hawaii, but there's also what happens if you don't get to go to Hawaii. We've got another caller, so I'm just going to go ahead and go. Hi, Maggie. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. One thing that I'm concerned about is someone who has just recently had surgery, there is no way that a doctor is going to prescribe controlled substances, you know, narcotics, beyond what they want you to. And they keep saying these things like keep your prescriptions in the kit. And there's no doctor who's going to write you a prescription to put in your kit. So I don't understand what a person's supposed to do.
Good question.
Yeah. I think what we mean is, you know, make sure you have a current supply that you can, that the doctor is willing to write, and that you take that with you. Also have a copy of the prescription, because we realize that there are going to be a lot of folks like you when you get to a shelter or that are going to have these kind of requirements for prescriptions. So that's high on the list that we're going to need to get that reconciled early on. So knowing or being able to document that you have this requirement prescriptions is a big deal.
That your medications are legal?
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially. So
yeah,
having
exactly.
a copy of the prescription, even a Xerox of it?
Yes. And then making sure when you leave, if you do have to leave, that you have enough of your prescription there with you. And that's a big deal. And I would talk to your doctor about that to say, hey, here are my concerns. And I am worried about not having enough for in case I have to evacuate.
And you're really talking about 5 to 7 days worth?
Is yes. That
you're,
yeah,
you know?
5 to 7 days worth.
Uh-huh.
So I'd recommend talking to your doctor about that. And there are, you know, it's expensive too. We realize that. It's just that you got to understand that when you get to a shelter, if that's the case, if you end up in a shelter or someplace other than your home, or even if you stay in your home, that medication is not going to necessarily be readily available to you. It's going to be disrupted.
Be yeah.
Now,
yeah.
The hospitals are on board with this too. We realize that there's a lot of people that get their medications through other means. And so getting that health department, the municipal health department, along with the state health, are aware of that. And they've got provisions or plans to address that during an emergency or disaster, how to get people their meds.
Good question, Maggie. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to Alex. Hi, Alex. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Hi. First time listener and first time caller.
Thank you.
One thing I've been thinking about, I've actually been doing a little research for a little documentary on the 64 earthquake, because next March is the 50th anniversary. And one thing that is peculiar to me is how Turnagain was kind of condemned after the earthquake. It sustained so much damage. What can we expect as people who live in Turnagain, and how were people allowed to build again there if it was condemned?
That's a good one. How about you, Kevin?
Sure. You know, that's, they look, what they do is they have to look at the area and its vulnerabilities. So, and I, our building safety guys could probably answer this better than me, but my understanding is it has to, there's a level of risk that you take when you build in those areas. And that's, it's not a risk-free area. It's a higher risk area than others. So whatever conditions or provisions they make it down there to make it developable, so it mitigates risk to an extent. But you're going to find that there are areas of the city that are at a higher risk during an earthquake than certain other areas. And it's important to be aware of that if you live in one of those high-risk zones. You know, our building department can tell you where those areas are and then how to do construction or construction techniques to deal with those levels of risk that you're in. But my understanding is if it were the level of risk that you're building in is acceptable to a certain degree. In other words, it isn't, they don't allow development on properties that have an unacceptable level of risk. Mm-hmm. So it's a higher risk, but it's not unacceptable. Uh-huh. But the folks into building safety can answer your questions and give you a better idea of what level of risk you're facing and what things you can do to either retrofit your house or check to see if that's in your house and give you a little more security about that.
Yeah. Gosh, great questions coming in from our callers. We're going to go to another call in just a minute, but I'm going to throw out the number just for folks who we often find people are waiting for us to give them the number because they want to ask a question. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 if you're outside of Anchorage, and please feel free to send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. I am going to go to Wayne. Hi, Wayne.
Yes, my comment here is why the authorities or the municipality underappreciate the ham radio operators. I'm KL3FA, and we have nets, emergency nets every week, and every year we have a get together off Kincaid where we prove our worth in reference to emergencies. It's been proven throughout under hurricanes and tornadoes that the ham operators are the ones that have a reliable system because we got solar panels, we have lead acid batteries, and we can communicate, and we provide a valuable service for all the municipality or emergency service personnel.
Okay, Wayne, we're going to have Kevin take that one.
Yeah, really good point, Wayne, and you're right. It's not that you're not appreciated. It's we had more of an active program. We've had some staffing reductions. We're increasing our staffing now, and we hope to engage and interface with you more and bring you into loop more. You're absolutely right. In any kind of emergency, the ham radio folks are going to be a big player for us. If you call my office, 343-1401, give me a call tomorrow morning, and we can talk more about it and getting your organization plugged into us. But you bring up a really good point.
Well,
thank you for it.
People stepping up, you really appreciate it. So, yeah, got to figure out how to fit them in. So that was a good thought there. Thanks a lot. I'm going to go to Scott. Hi, Scott. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call. Great show.
Good. What's your question?
My question, well, I tell you, I have a question. I think a lot, you guys talk, kind of hit all the bases on everything, I think, and except for one. And I understand that maybe because of the group you have there, they're not very excited about talking about this particular thing, but it's personal protection. I think we can assume that during an emergency like a large earthquake, that the police are going to be hampered in their ability to respond to protecting the citizens from criminals. And we can also assume that the criminals aren't going anywhere. There's still going to be criminals around. And the criminals may or may not have prepared as well as the people that aren't criminals.
Right.
So my suggestion is that maybe there would be some comments, some talk from your gentlemen about what type of firearm or other device would be used to protect yourself from criminals during such
an event? All right, Scott, we got your question. I'm scanning the room to see who wants to jump up. How about Mark Mew from the APD?
Okay, well, that was a loaded question.
Yes, it was.
Well, you know, this is Alaska, and we're probably already the best armed state in the free world, or in the United States. You know, I think you could get into a discussion that would go forever amongst gun aficionados about what their favorite choice of personal protective equipment would be. So I don't know that I want to do that. But, you know, people have handguns. They have short shoulder weapons. A lot of folks have that kind of stuff. You know, I think there's probably a lot of information on what's effective personal protection in the way, you know, gosh.
There's not a simple answer. I mean,
I don't think there's a simple answer. I can't stand here and tell you I think everybody needs to go out get a certain brand and a certain caliber of semi-automatic pistol.
Yeah.
Some people favor handguns. Some people favor short shoulder weapons like shotguns in terms of home protection.
But we're not talking that Mad Max is going to happen in Anchorage and you suddenly have to have a fortress in your house. I mean, that's what I thought he was getting
at. No, I think what the situation we'd be faced with would be looters in commercial parts of town and stuff like that. I think that's the kind of thing you probably would see. And the police department would be doing its best to keep up with that. We would probably be taxed and probably would not be able to effectively deal with every single looter.
Yeah. You know, Scott, we want to get onto some other calls because we've got a lot of calls coming in and we want to get as many of them as we can. So I think we got that to the best of our ability right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go to Jordan. Hi, Jordan. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Oh, my question is, what do you guys do with all the inmates in Anchorage Jail and, you know, Cook Inlet? Do you guys just, like, throw them a little bit of food and... you know, have all the COs leave and evacuate, or how do you guys deal with that?
This is Mark at the police department. None of us here work for state DOC, but I do know that Department of Corrections has its own emergency plans, and I'm a little bit familiar with McLaughlin Youth Center's plans only because I sit on their advisory board. So I know those plans are in effect, and I think there is probably versions of them that allow the inmates to stay in the facility, and there are probably versions of those plans when it's necessary to move them to correctional facilities elsewhere. I don't know the details, but I do know that DOC knows the details, and they do have plans.
Okay. All right. That's good. Let's see. We've got a caller. Rick, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Well, thanks, and thanks for the program. As others have said, it's a good program. I am the administrator of an assisted living home, and the state requires us to have preparations in advance for local disasters, you know, small neighborhood versus also bigger disasters, by, you know, having disaster kits for individual residents, as well as having a facility supply of things. And anybody could go to the state health and social services site to at least get a, you know, they could use them as resource. I don't know if that's the best way to get that resource, but there are resources out there for how to sort of stock yourself up for a week's supply or so. And I think there is guaranteed to be a lot of chaos for the people who don't do anything but just expect others to take care of them. But I think for listeners and for the families of listeners, friends of listeners, if they at least do a little preventative care, set up some supplies that are, you know, going to last for a long period of time, get themselves prepared for those things, they're going to be in a lot better shape and not be so dependent on APD, a hospital, et cetera. There are some, you know, the interesting point that somebody made about the prescription med issues, that is going to be a difficulty that, I mean, I don't even know how we would deal with it beyond a week's supply.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'm really glad you guys are doing this, but I would encourage listeners to do the best they can to prepare ahead of time, just like they would stock their car in the winter with warm stuff. stock your house with some non-perishables, a water supply that you can change out, etc.
Thank you, Rick.
Otherwise, I'm going to keep on listening.
Thanks, Rick, and really appreciate you sort of spreading the message. It's why we had the show. Now, two people were raising their hands. I wanted to jump in and follow you, Rick. What was your point, Mark?
This is Mark at the police department. The last two callers both hit on different sides of the same issue, and it goes back to when we're talking about evacuating Anchorage. I think there is a good opportunity that we could evacuate special needs. There's enough road infrastructure that if we needed to get prisoners out, if we needed to get people out of assisted living homes, other special needs people to other towns that could maybe had capacity to take care of them. That's where I think the getting out of town piece might work. Having everybody pick up 300,000 people leaving Anchorage at once is not going to work. So for the rest of us that don't have special needs, that's why it's important for us to get ourselves squared away so that we can take care of ourselves during this period
of
time.
And Kevin, you wanted to jump
in
too.
No, that's a good question. And I think it's really interesting that somebody who operates an assisted care facility calls in. That's been a lot of our focus here, particularly the last year. We worked actually pretty closely here recently with the Anchorage Senior Center, and they've got different you know levels of care there, and to include a large dementia ward. And we did the what if game and went through a tabletop exercise with them if they had to evacuate, and even just one facility that can quickly get to a point where it overwhelms other local resources. So if you have a widespread incident like Mark was just saying, where you have multiple assisted care facilities, that can quickly get out of hand and become unmanageable. So all the more reason, as the caller just pointed out, for those folks to be able to take care of themselves. And one of the things I can't stress enough is, you know, people will have backup generators, and that's really important if you're running a business or an assisted care, or you're providing care to other people or a dialysis center. But having backup heat is also important. A lot of people have the backup generator, but they don't have a backup means of heat. And in a large event, there is a chance that we lose natural gas pressure to parts of the city, and that's the energy emergency that we talk about. And the consequences, third order and effects of that are pretty significant. So if you're running an assisted care place, the ability to stay there, even if natural gas is disrupted, you're going to be miles ahead. You're going to be able to better care for your folks, and it's just going to go a long way. So you know, that's a big deal if you're running a business or you're running a facility where you're caring for people. That ability to have that backup heat. Now, the gas system is pretty robust here within Anchorage, and in fact, most of it survived the 64 earthquake. But in the event you have pieces of the city that don't, where you may have the buildings are intact, but the gas may be out, and that could, you know, pretty much make it difficult to shelter in those areas or those facilities.
An event in June is going to be way different than an event in January.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, we've got, a couple more minutes. The phones have finally calmed down a little bit. I want to sort of go around and sort of leave, you know, think about what you want people to leave with this. I know that some of it is be prepared, but what words would you like to leave with people, and if there's tips on, you know, where the good lists are, like, you know, or, you know, whether there's actually companies out there that do something that's reasonable that you could just one-stop shop, you know. So let's go with you, Kevin.
Yeah, sure. Like I said, get a kit, make a plan, be prepared or stay informed. And what, you know, if you go up our website, www.muni.org/OEM, it's got all kind of information there from how to prepare for a volcano.
Even break down, what kind of disaster, a volcano, a tsunami, a terrorist attack, you know, you can just really go down and it's a print, you open up a PDF and you can print it out.
Exactly.
And then
ready.gov, same thing. It's got all kind of information there and it's all free. And they've tailored it to if you live in northern climates or if you live in Tornado Alley or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So there's all kind of information out there. And then if you have any questions on the best place to go, just give our office a call. We're between 8 and 5 Monday through Friday, and that's 343-1401. Just give us a call, and we can help get you pointed in the right direction.
We'll add that number to the website after the show. I did want to tell folks that you, the Office of Emergency Management, has been running these brown bag lunch seminars, and for the whole year of 2013, maybe before that too. But there's some coming up, and I just thought I'd throw these dates out. September 6th, they're doing Back to Preparedness Basics, Get a Kit, Make a Plan, Be Informed, Get Involved. These are all at the BP Energy Center at 900 East Benson Boulevard from 12 to 1. So September 6th is kind of a Back to Basics. October 4th is Preparing for the Zombie Apocalypse, which is a pretty clever title there. November 8th is Winter, Not Always a Wonderland. And December 6th is 12 Days of Christmas Preparedness, Great Gift Ideas for the Preppers in Your Life. So that's something, if you're, if this show motivated you and got you thinking, geez, I'm not really where I should be, there's some help at hand.
That, the Zombie Apocalypse one, I believe, is put on by our health department, and I think there may be more word out on that, and I think they hope to maybe do flu shots or something like that.
So how about you, Mike? What do you want to leave people thinking about?
I want to make sure people know how seriously the school district takes the mission of being prepared to protect their children, protect our students and staff in the event of an emergency. And folks should absolutely check in with their building principals or their classroom teachers. I'm confident that they're going to hear good information about the level of preparation that the school has taken, and they're going to be even more confident that their children are in good hands when they're at school.
And maybe have that, think about having that talk with your kids, which is, okay, if something big happens and you can't reach me, you know, how's it going to be?
Exactly.
You know, so that your child is somewhat reassured that, that you've thought of this and that there's a plan in place.
Yeah, and we really, an issue we frequently deal with in situations like this are kids that have separated families where their mom and dad may not live together, and it's important for those families to have a good coordination between them. You don't really want the school to try to be the one to sort that out, especially on a bad day.
Yeah, and these are all things that really, if people would take it, the opportunity in advance, you could really smooth the waters quite a bit. So some work to be done, really.
Yeah.
And how about you, Mark? You have been in the middle of both at the school district and at the APD and emergency preparations. What would you really like people to do?
Well, I'd like them to remember that if something big happens, we're going to take damage as well. And so the police and the fire responders are going to be not only have the most work they've ever had to do, they're probably going to be doing it with less people and equipment that they normally have. That means we can't get to everything. We have to get to the worst stuff first. So our behavior is going to be a little different. We may drive by small problems or even medium-sized problems in order to have to deal with a really big problem. And so people say, why aren't they stopping around my house, which is fallen? It's because we're going to a freeway bridge that's fallen. We expect us to behave differently, expect us to follow a triage approach to things, but the big takeaway is if you can square yourself away so that you don't need us, if you can take care of yourself, then that leaves us with a fighting chance to help the people who really do need it.
Yeah. I also, you know, one thing I thought about was this neighborhood idea. People kind of getting out in their neighborhoods, and I don't know whether the community councils do any organizing along these lines or Neighborhood Watch does anything like that. Do you know, Kevin?
Yeah, we have a Neighborhood Watch program, and it's...
We're out of time.
Okay.
Well, we
check
do have a Neighborhood
website.
Watch. Yeah, check the website. Gosh, I really want to thank our guests today. We had Kevin Spillers from the Muni Office of Emergency Management, Mike Abbott from the Anchorage School District, and Mark Mew from the Anchorage Police Department. Really want to thank all our callers. A lot of thoughtful questions today, and we really appreciate it. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Charles Wolforth hosts filmmaker Mary Katsky and her son, Corin. Their film is premiering next month in Anchorage, about a year-long journey they took learning in fifth-grade classrooms around the world. Please connect with us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Our website is alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Platt is our audio engineer. And thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.